We're talking about a pricing plan for state parks on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Market forces are behind the new pricing system for camping and park entrance fees. Rates go up at some of the most popular state parks during peak times. The DNR reported last week that year-over-year revenue rose 10% in the last half of 2018. What do you think about the DNR's new pricing system? Are you avoiding popular parks because of fees? Are you visiting other parks for the first time instead? Have state park prices changes affected your vacation plans? We're at 800-642-1234. Chris Pradretti is Section Chief for the Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Parks and Recreation. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So why did the DNR decide to change its entrance and camping fees at state parks after this loss of funding from tax dollars?
Well, most of our fees, our rates are set with the state budgets. And when we went to the self-funding model, we certainly needed to look for new opportunities to continue that growth and continue the revenue that all goes back into supporting the state parks and those properties and all the operational budgets.
Explain how this pricing system works.
Well, it's really just looking at it in a demand-based way. We did an extensive study of the camping and the admission at a lot of our properties. We looked at the camping throughout the whole system, looked at occupancy rates historically, year over year. We broke it into seasonality. We looked weekend versus weekday occupancy rates. We looked at electric sites versus non-electric sites and really determined where that demand would justify a slight price increase, and also on the other end, where there was opportunity for growth at some of the properties, and we also lowered prices at many of the properties as well.
So lowering prices at properties where you would like more of an influx of people to try out this particular camping opportunity, camping site. How much did the fees increase at like a popular park like Devil's Lake?
Well, the camping fees increased, like at a Devil's Lake, anywhere from about $5 to the max of $7 a night. And when I say that, that's not an across-the-board increase. That may be just on a weekend at electric sites that increase took place. So it really we really broke it up and looked at those kind of opportunities. We also looked at the admission, and we were given the flexibility to do the same program with daily admissions. At the properties. So at a place like Devil's Lake, which is our most popular, most visited property in the system, we also increased the daily admission rates as well. And that went up at that property $5 for a daily admission. But what I will say is annual admission, if anybody buying an annual sticker, those prices remained the same. So that opportunity still remained.
Interesting how you use the word properties. We see them as state parks. You're really looking at the business side of them. These are properties. To you, and you have to stay in the black.
That's correct. And yes, so I say properties a lot because when we talk state park system, it really is obviously the state parks make up a large part of that, and that's what a lot of people relate to. But it also is the state forest all over the state and the state recreation areas as well. So we get kind of trained to say properties instead of just saying parks.
Has the new system offset the loss of tax revenue so far?
It certainly helped. I mean, the way we're operating now, we are certainly looking at it more as much as we can as a business model. As the state park system and in the state parks, all the dollars that we make at the parks stay with the state parks and go back into the operations. And like I said, we needed to look at ways to continue being successful. We've been seeing increased users, increased camping. That's been the trend over the years, which is great. And we need to continue to make those opportunities available for everyone to come out and enjoy.
We're talking about a new pricing system for state parks. Chris Pradretti is a section chief for the DNR's Bureau of Parks and Recreation. What questions do you have about the DNR's pricing system and how it works? Have you been surprised by the cost to enter a state park or to stay at a campground? Do you have suggestions for ways the DNR could raise money through other means? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Chris, how has park attendance fared since the changes? What have you seen?
Well, over the past many years, we've seen a steady increase in park users and property users. We have over 17 million estimated users in our state park system each year, and so they're well used, which is great. And we're seeing increases every year. Last year, we had over 17 million users. A slight decrease from the year before. Everybody remembers last year was not the greatest weather. Especially at the
sure.
end of the year,
flooding.
So we certainly have to look at those weather conditions as well. But still having over 17 million users again last year, even with all the other factors, was a great thing. It's really showing that people love getting out into the state parks.
We have an email from Matt in Wausau who wants to know: has anyone looked into the amount that companies like Reserve America are charging just to make reservations? Their fees can represent 25% of a rental for a weekend at Devil's Lake.
Sure. So the reference to Reserve America, we have a vendor that handles our reservation system for the state park system. Right now, we actually have a new vendor this year. We use a new system and not Reserve America anymore, but they do charge a reservation fee, and that is obviously the revenue that they make off of doing that for us and charging that fee. Depending on the length of stay, it can be a greater percentage depending how long you stay. But when we do over 200,000 reservations, and we have over 400,000 nights stayed throughout the properties. We have over 6,000 campsites throughout the state. So it's a huge system, and we absolutely have to have some type of a reservation system management piece to be able to manage.
Do you bid that out?
We do. Yep. It just like any other contract with the state, we go through a standard bidding process. We did that last year when the contract ended with Reserve America, and a new vendor was selected, which we rolled out this past December. So it's a standard request for proposal process, and we look at all the options, what best fits the needs of our customers, and go from there.
Since you rolled out this new pricing system, has it worked as you expected? Will there be tweaks?
Yes, certainly always tweaks. We're always looking at it, reviewing it. We look at the fees annually to see if there's any tweaks that need to be made. We're very happy with the early numbers that are coming in. Again, I tell everyone it's a small sample size. We only implemented this last February, so it's really only been a year since we implemented these fees. We're not looking at changing any fees in the demand-based program this year, so everything will remain the same throughout 2019. We have seen still an increase in advance reservations from last year when we rolled this out, so that's a good sign. We are looking at doing some other options. We have a dynamic pricing model, so we're looking to hopefully doing some maybe specials, people would call it, looking at more of the short-term pricing structure. If a property has some openings, next weekend, we can roll out something with maybe $5 off, maybe drive some more campers to some other properties that need a little more love.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for stopping by.
Sure, thank you.
Chris Padretti is a section chief for the Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Parks and Recreation. We've been talking about the new structure for fee systems for park reservations. Coming up, we explore a collection of letters from a Civil War soldier sent home to his family in Wisconsin. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring Civil War letters sent home to Wisconsin. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Captain Henry F. Young's letters to his wife Delia and his family are a window into war, society, and politics. And the letters reveal a man trying to stay connected to his family and to make sure that they have enough money to cover debts in Grant County and keep their sawmill operational. Do you have a family member or know someone from Wisconsin who served in the Civil War? What was their role? What historical mementos do you have of their time in service? We're at 800-642-1234. Mike Larson edited the collection of letters called Dear Delia, Civil War Letters of Captain Henry F. Young, 7th Wisconsin Infantry. It's published by UW Press. He teaches American history in the Menominee School District. And he joins us this morning from our studios in Eau Claire. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate. And on behalf of my co-editor, Dr. John David Smith, thanks for the program.
Well, let's start where the letters do, at Camp Randall. It's a landmark many Wisconsinites know well. It's the home of Badger football in Madison. And this is the place where 70,000 Union recruits were trained. Can you take us to Camp Randall in the 1860s? What's going on there?
Well, it's a lot different than what it would be today, of course, on a Badger game day. quite a bit different, actually. Back in the day, it would have been more on the edge of the city, perhaps, and the training at Camp Randall would not be anything similar or even remotely close to what our men and women today in the armed forces receive. The 7th Wisconsin, in particular, they showed up in late August, and by late September, they were on a train heading to Washington, D.C. Much of their training really was about trying to stay in formation, left foot, right foot, how to wheel their unit, and how to fire effectively. But it would have been a more or less just a big open field compared to what we would think of today when you show up on Saturday afternoons.
And many men are coming in from all over Wisconsin to Camp Randall?
Yes. The way it worked often with these regiments is in all these individual communities throughout the state. For example, in Eau Claire, there was a Company C that became part of the 8th Wisconsin. When they put a company together, that company of men would eventually secure transportation, in this case, make their way to Camp Randall. And then when roughly 10 companies got together, then they would be formed into a regiment. And so the 10 companies that made up the 7th Wisconsin came from all over the state of Wisconsin. Company A, for example, was from Chippewa Falls. Young's company was known as the Lancaster Union Guards, and they were predominantly from Grant County. And that's the way it worked throughout a good chunk of the war, as far as at least in the early years when they showed up at either Camp Randall or any of the other training grounds throughout the state. They would, once they had 10 companies, they gave them about 1 month of training and sent them off to fight.
Were these men volunteers? How were they recruited?
Early in the war, they were all volunteers. Through about the end of 1862, before the first draft in American history occurred, when Lincoln's call for more volunteers resulted in the draft, these men were all volunteers, especially for the first roughly 2 years of the war. And from that point forward, it was a little mixture of both.
When the Civil War started in 1861, Wisconsin was a really young state. At the time, it was only about 13 years old. What was life like for the average Wisconsinite?
Wisconsin was mostly an agrarian state, and I believe most statistics put it at about 88% to 90% rural. For example, Madison, I believe, only probably around 5,000 people in 1861, so a relatively small community. Eau Claire, for example, about 3,300 people. So most of the people who lived in Wisconsin, they would have been considered Westerners at that time. They would not have, maybe Midwest comes in a little bit later, but Minnesota had just reached statehood just a few years before that. So this was a very young area of the country, and most people living here were definitely rural in nature.
We're talking about a collection of Civil War letters. Mike Larson is our guide. His new book is Dear Delia, Civil War Letters of Captain Henry F. Young, 7th Wisconsin Infantry. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the Civil War and Wisconsin's involvement? Have you ever attended a football game at Camp Randall? What do you appreciate about its history? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. So let's take a look here. Up until September of 1862, the main focus of the Civil War had been to preserve the Union. What happened after President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation? What changed?
Oh, I think initially, I think all of this, including even Captain Young, I think this, they evolve over time. And while Young even mentions earlier in his letters, this war is not about the abolition of slavery, but the preservation of the Union, eventually things evolve. And in the case of Young even, you can see this transformation take place over time. And the early Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln presented it to his cabinet in July of 1862, and he wanted to make it public. However, with things not going so well for the Union Army, I think it was Henry Seward, his Secretary of State, urged him to wait for at least a Union victory of sorts, which occurred with the stopping of General Lee's army at Antietam in Maryland. And afterwards, 4 days afterwards, Lincoln issued the initial proclamation to free the enslaved Africans only in the states that were in active rebellion against the Union. It did not actually free any enslaved Africans in the four border states.
What changed for African American soldiers?
They didn't initially start to join, and initially it was fought. They were not necessarily welcomed at first. However, as time went on, I believe, just like all of these things, the evolution of thinking was that at some point this can at least as a military measure to help shorten the war.
Let's rewind back to your time as a student at UW-Eau Claire. It's 1985. You're assigned a research project, and that's when you select the Civil War, where you learn of Captain Henry F. Young. Can you introduce us to him?
Captain Young was born in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. We don't know a whole lot about his early life. We know that he made his way to Wisconsin in roughly the year 1850. He worked on the riverboats on the Mississippi, and Grant County is a prominent place. And at some point, he comes into contact with Jared Warner, his future father-in-law. And at some point, he obviously notices Warner's daughter, Delia. And after a fairly short courtship, he started work in roughly September, I believe, of 1852 for Warner. And by March 1853, they're married. So that it was not a long courtship.
And not long after they're married, they get established, and then it's wartime.
Yes. They purchased a mill. Warner and Young purchased a grist mill in 1858, and not too long after that, yes, the Civil War breaks out. Young actually mentions that he's trout fishing in Rattlesnake Creek when he hears about the firing on Fort Sumter. And he had perhaps one of the reasons that he's made an officer. Number one, he's a little older than the average man at the time. He's 36 years of age. He's not stepping out of high school here at this point. And part of it is he had helped train some soldiers that ended up in a different regiment in the 6th Wisconsin, I believe. So once another group of soldiers from Grant County started training, I think that his previous training of soldiers probably led to his election as a first lieutenant in what will become Company F of the 7th Wisconsin Infantry.
Where did you uncover Captain Young's letters?
Ironically, at UW-Eau Claire, when I began this project, I went to the archives, and my initial interest was actually Company A, which was from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, of the 7th Wisconsin. However, there really wasn't a whole lot of information on Company A, and part of our work really involved looking at some of the primary resources. So that led me to broaden things out throughout the 7th, and talking with the archivist at the time, Rick Pfeiffer, he suggested these papers at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and that's when it all started. And they shipped them to Eau Claire. And I always felt, not even looking at all of the letters at that time, I was very much captivated by what Young had written home to Delia. even at that time. And it was always my goal, and at least the back of my mind, that I should revisit this. I guess I didn't realize it would take two decades.
Well, there are 155 letters.
it was a lengthy correspondence, and Young was not. He was very, very diligent in writing as much as he could home to her and to Jared. The majority of the letters are to Delia, but he does probably around 15% of the letters are to Jared as well. And yes, the transcription took about 3 years of time, other than my other day job. So
the book is called Dear Delia. Author Mike Larson stays with us. He edited the collection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does Wisconsin history interest you? What should we know about the Civil War and Wisconsin's involvement? Do you find that history can tell itself through letters sent to family and friends? Call in 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. We'll continue this look at the Civil War and its connection to Wisconsin right after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're exploring a collection of Civil War correspondence from an Army soldier to his family in Wisconsin. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and the book is called Dear Delia, Civil War Letters of Captain Henry F. Young, 7th Wisconsin Infantry. Here's a bit of one dated Camp Arlington, 1862. Dear Delia, we're having a severe snowstorm. In fact, it looks more like winter this evening than any time yet. It had just begun to dry up the mud, and the snow will go off tomorrow and make it worse than ever, if that were possible. Look at the Harper's Weekly I sent you. At that picture, why the Army of the Potomac don't move, and you will have a true picture of our situation. Do you know someone from Wisconsin who served during the Civil War? What was their story? Join in at 800-642-1234. Author Mike Larson stays with us. He edited the collection. Let's go to the phones now with Willie joining us from Steuben. Hi, Willie.
Hey, how's it going? Can you hear me all right?
We can indeed.
Very well. Hey, I was a logger for 20 years, and I saw a lot of things in the woods. And over by Middle Ridge, just east of La Crosse, I got to the top of the hill one day, and there was a wall about 4 feet tall. And it went for a long ways. And I asked the landowner, what is this? And he says it was a Civil War boot camp training area, and they picked up rocks and they built a wall on top of this hill, and it has like kitchen area. It's the craziest thing I ever saw, and I want to know if anybody knows anything about it.
Willie, thanks for the call. What do we know about this?
I think that what you discover is with all of these companies that train throughout the state, Young, for example, he trained guys in his front yard of his home. So I think, I would suspect anyway, it would just be a guess, but when these neighbors would get together to do some training, they could have done just about anything to prepare themselves, and they might have constructed a wall such as this, almost a small training area, and several groups of companies might have actually come through that. I guess I wouldn't see that as terribly unusual. There were major training grounds throughout the state, such as Camp Randall. There was Camp Utley, which was in Racine. There was a camp also, Fond du Lac, I believe. And there were Camp Washburn by Milwaukee. So those were the large camps. But certainly, I think throughout the state, when these men came together, I wouldn't think it'd be terribly unusual that they might have constructed something to either help or at least aid in their training over time.
Mike, how did the 7th Wisconsin Infantry Regiment and other regiments then become the Iron Brigade, basically the most celebrated military organizations of the Civil War?
Yes, when the 7th showed up in Washington, D.C., they were put together with the 2nd, the 6th Wisconsin, and the 19th Indiana. And after about a year in the Eastern Theater, they were joined by the 24th Michigan. They really did get their name from a battle that occurred just a few days before Antietam at a place called South Mountain. And the regiments were advancing up South Mountain, which is literally a mountain in Maryland. And as they were advancing under just a terrific fire from the Confederates who occupied the higher position, these Wisconsin boys, Indiana and Michigan boys, kept advancing through this hail of gunfire. And several generals were overwatching this, McClellan, Hooker, and General Burnside. And McClellan is reported to have said, who are those men? And I believe Hooker said the various regiments involved. And McClellan's comment, paraphrasing a bit, was, well, those men must be made of iron. And from that point forward, they were often known as the Iron Brigade of the West, or just plain the Iron Brigade.
You put Captain Young's letters in chronological order. Having done that, what do we learn from Captain Young's letter specifically that helps us understand what the Civil War was like?
For Captain Young, I think the things that pervade his letters more than anything is his intense loyalty to the Union. He is deeply, intensely patriotic. You'll see that bleed throughout a lot of his letters home. And he's also a true family man. He's very concerned about life back home here in dear old Wisconsin. And he's worried about Delia, and he's worried about his children. And even more so in the bigger context, he's worried about the Union. He's there to preserve and protect the Union. And he sees his role as maybe one small cog in that larger endeavor to somehow unify this Union that was fractured by the firing at Fort Sumter in April of 1861.
Help us understand what he was doing in the battles, in the theater, if you will, in leading the men and also having to pick up the dead.
His earliest recollections, he was on detached service for a while. In March of 1862, he was selected to build bridges. And part of that might be, again, his age and maybe some of his other life experiences. And he was on detached service with what was known as McDowell's Engineer Corps from roughly March through early September 1862. And he experienced the Second Battle of Bull Run, for example, from the vantage point of the Construction Corps. But we also know that he witnessed his first dead after the Battle of Cedar Mountain, which was August 9th, 1862. And he basically says this is a hard thing to do. To pick up men after they've lain in the sun for 3 or 4 days. This is not pleasant duty. Ironically, Young does not talk a whole lot about the marching, the left-right kind of stuff that would occur during a battle. But he talks about his men a little bit. And when men are either wounded or killed in combat, he'll send that list to Delia and to Jared, probably knowing full well that these are their friends and family from back home. And it was also another way to kind of let family back home know what had happened to their loved ones.
He was doing some reporting as well from the field.
He was, and I'm sure it was not an easy thing for him to do. And in some cases, he'll lose some very dear friends along the way. One of his neighbors, his son was died of disease in 1862, and he lamented how sad he was at the loss of this young man, because he was a good young man, and you know the world had lost a fine young person at that point.
Let's take another call now. Let's go to Clyde joining us from Cedarburg. Hi, Clyde.
Hi. Thank you very much for the research that you've done, careful research using primary sources. That's extremely important to try to get at the truth. There's a particular region of Wisconsin that was kind of anomalous during the Civil War. It stuck out in contrast to the overwhelming sentiment of all of the immigrants who had recently come to Wisconsin and when it became a state in 1848. And this region was made up of two counties. Abraham Lincoln ran for president and was he won election in 1860 and re-election in 1864, and he won overwhelmingly in Wisconsin. But in this particular region, Abraham Lincoln was resoundingly rejected for president by margins of between 3-1 to 8-1. When Fort Sumter was attacked, There was an emergency measure that was enacted in the in the state legislature to protect the federal government and to give assistance, which didn't have the a lot of resources available to it. Many of the states did this. It was overwhelmingly passed in Wisconsin, but this particular region, the state legislature that represented it, voted against the resolution. Fort Sumter, or rather Camp Randall, you mentioned during the Civil War, there was an armed insurrection, the only armed insurrection that ever occurred against the United States, that occurred in Wisconsin during wartime, occurred in this region.
Clyde, let's pause right here and look at what opposition was there to the Civil War, especially in Wisconsin.
Well, you know, this is interesting. I guess I don't know a whole lot about what Clyde is talking about, but I'd be interested in knowing more about that. It is true that in most throughout Wisconsin, most people voted for Lincoln, but there are a few places where Lafayette County, for example, and near Grant County, where Young grew up, was often considered to be a hotbed of Copperhead movements for those who basically favored either a peaceful resolution to the war or ending the war completely. And so I think that, generally speaking, as Clyde said, you know, most Wisconsinites were resounding for Lincoln, but not everywhere.
What does Captain Young's letters reveal about the role of women during the Civil War?
For Delia, she was, I think, maybe the letters prove out that she was kind of on equal footing with Captain Young, I believe, throughout the course of the war. And maybe part of this was, as a young woman, she had an upbringing that was probably not similar to what other young women would have had in her area. She attended the Platteville Academy.
Is that what is Knox College now?
No.
No? Okay.
That would be, this would have been maybe like a prep school.
Okay.
And then later on, she attended a female seminary, which later became Knox College. And she was given a fairly rigorous curriculum in mathematics and science, which, interestingly, was different than the boys' curriculum, which later became more on the classics. So she had quite a background in math and science. And throughout his letters, it's fairly pointed that you can tell Young, he knows his wife knows what she's talking about. He's not trying to fool her at all, because he knows he's not going to be able to get away with it.
We're talking with Mike Larson. He edited the collection of 155 letters of Captain Henry F. Young to his family in Wisconsin. It's called Dear Delia. Join in 800-642-1234. Do you have a family member from Wisconsin who served during the Civil War? What was their role? How did they describe their service? You can call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a collection of Civil War correspondence from a soldier to his family in Wisconsin. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The book is called Dear Delia, Civil War Letters of Captain Henry F. Young, 7th Wisconsin Infantry. Here's one dated Belle Plaine, Virginia, 1863. Delia, this is the anniversary of our marriage, and I have thought so much about it and let my mind run on home and the dear ones there that I am almost homesick. You don't know how lonesome a person can get out on an outpost. There everything is quiet. All an officer has to do is to post his men to guard against surprise. And as there is no chance of sleeping at night on the outpost, a person has time to think. Join in 800-642-1234. Do you find that history can tell itself through letters sent to family? Should we use this approach to get a better grasp on other parts of history? Mike Larson is our guide. He edited this collection, and he chronicles the story of Captain Young. Mike, the letters, again and again, Captain Young is really concerned about the money situation of his family, that his kids have enough, that his enough money is going to his father-in-law, and that seems to be one of the threads going through his letters, that he wants to make sure everyone is okay back home.
No doubt. He was very, very worried. And I think part of it maybe, you know, he in a small way feels guilty to be gone while all this is going on, yet knowing his greater duty to the preservation of the Union. But he's very concerned about making sure that his debts get paid. And in that way, I don't see him being a whole lot different than most people today. He wanted to make sure that his kids were in good shape. He wanted to make sure that his wife was taken care of. And he wanted to make sure that he met all of his financial obligations. You could tell he does not want to be that person that they talk about saying, oh, he didn't pay his debts. So he's really worried about it. And yes, as you stated, these things come through his letters frequently.
Let's go to Michael now, joining us from Bear Valley. Michael, hi.
Hi there. My great-great-grandfather served in the Civil War and is buried in Reedsburg, Wisconsin. He's originally from Denmark. He served in the Iron Brigade and fought at Bull Run, Antietam, Fredericksburg, and Gettysburg, and Wilderness, Virginia, and was wounded a couple of times. And I'm very much interested, having spent a little time this year traveling to Shiloh, the memorial down there. It was quite a stunning sight to see the battlefield there. And I've been reading a lot of books about the war, especially Shiloh, since then. I was curious about how one could go about finding more information about a family member that served in the Civil War here in Wisconsin through the Historical Society. Do you have any strategies that might be useful for us?
Great question. I think for myself, that's probably the best starting point. The Wisconsin Historical Society is renowned throughout the country for its collection of letters and papers and documentary evidence, especially on the Civil War and Wisconsin's history. But they also have letters from other states as well. And I think that would be, if you're looking to get into any type of research, Wisconsin history especially, but that would be a great starting point, in my opinion, as well as our regional universities. So, for example, I believe you're from the La Crosse area. They also have a special collections, and that's a great place to start as well for this kind of research. And there are, ironically, quite a few letters still out there to be explored, in my opinion, on the Civil War soldiers from especially Wisconsin, but certainly from throughout the country.
Let's go to Georgia now in Delavan. Georgia, hi.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
My great uncle was in the Civil War, my grandfather's brother. And in restoring the farmhouse, which was built by my Norwegian ancestors, I found a box of Civil War letters, both from my great uncle and to him from the family.
Wow.
He was in the 13th Regiment, I think, Company H.
Okay.
And that was very interesting. But one letter was written to my great aunt. It was all about Lincoln's assassination, and he mentions Booth and how sorry he was that they had to kill Booth, because that punishment was not enough to kill such a great man as President Lincoln. And it's just wonderful to have these letters in such good condition also.
I hope you have them in safekeeping, Georgia.
I have them in my safe deposit box, yes.
That's a good place.
Yes. And so I just feel just thrilled to be able to have these letters.
Georgia, thanks for the call. Mike.
Very interesting.
Yeah, and you had a large volume of letters here, and you decided to preserve as much integrity of the letters, in terms of how you used punctuation and what you would decide, how you preserved the writing style. What was your tactic there?
Initially, when I transcribed them, I went word for word. I left everything just exactly as Young had written it. And when we reached the final editing stage, Dr. Gwen Walker suggested, along with a few others at the press, that we add a little punctuation, not changing any of the words, but just to make it a little easier to read. And that was a great suggestion. And so the letters you read are literally word for word from Young. And the only time that we felt we had to do anything is if perhaps a word was so unrecognizable that we had to adjust it a little bit in brackets to help the reader. But to my knowledge, I think that was only maybe twice throughout the entire set of letters. So Young wrote well. He just didn't always punctuate well.
Mm. Take us to the end of his service. What happened to Captain Young?
Towards the end, he enlisted in the summer in 1864 in the Veteran Volunteer Corps, which were a lot of the men of the 7th. You could tell how loyal these men were. A good chunk of the regiment signed up, those who were still left anyway, and they will sign up for another term of duty, so to speak. And Young is fine with that. It took a little convincing, though. You can tell from the letters that Delia wasn't exactly thrilled with the prospect of him being gone even longer. However, by November of 1864, a few letters start to creep in, some sickness in his young daughter, Laura. And then he gets really heartbreaking news in November of 1864, and probably one of the hardest letters he has to write home from the one that he had received from both Delia and from Jared, telling him that his young daughter had passed away to diphtheria. And it's at that point, I think he had his breaking point. And I think that was the point when he decided he had served his country for 3 years. No one would begrudge him to leave the service at that time. And so he approached the regimental commander at that time was Holland Richardson of Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. And he asked for his discharge. And Holland Richardson granted it without any question at all. And on the front, it's all the proper paperwork, but on the back of the discharge, he writes, "A fine officer and a good man."
Mm. As we wrap up here, what do we know about the rest of his life?
The rest of his life, Captain Young returns home, probably gets home sometime around Christmas of 1864, and he probably does what a lot of us try to do, and especially soldiers when they return home. He tries to put the pieces of his life back together, and he returns to the mill. And he'll spend a little over a decade there. In 1878, probably either tiring of the mill or maybe Delia wants to be a little closer to her family, they sell the mill and they move to a little further north, just north of Patch Grove in Grant County. And they take up running Jared's farm, which he'll do till around 1894. In 1894, he suffers a stroke that debilitates him a little bit, and they move to Bloomington, where he lives out the rest of his life till 1902.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. This was quite a pleasure.
Mike Larson is author of Dear Delia, Civil War Letters of Captain Henry F. Young, 7th Wisconsin Infantry. He teaches American history in the Menominee School District, and he joined us from our studios in Eau Claire. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.